My story begins back in 2011, when my family and I purchased a large acreage of property north of Fairbanks, Alaska. The surrounding lands were a breathtaking sight, with thick timber, rolling hills, and vast acreage suitable for farmland. It was a dream come true for us. At that time, I was just 14 years old, and my family consisted of my two older brothers, aged 17 and 18, my older sister at 16, and of course, my mom and dad. We moved into a large farmhouse that had undergone multiple renovations since its original construction in 1908. The lane the house sat on was surrounded by the wild, lush Alaskan wilderness, and wildlife such as wolves, moose, and bears were common sights to us. We were accustomed to being cautious when necessary. The farmhouse was spacious, with a somewhat barn-like structure on one end of the property. This structure, while not entirely a barn, had the appearance of a renovated storage shed, possibly used for hay storage in the past. On the other side of the property, there was a smaller typical storage shed. The house itself was a 5-bedroom, 4-bathroom beauty, completely remodeled and expanded over the years. The previous owners were friends with my parents, which allowed us to get a great deal on the property. Our family's intention was to expand our family and have livestock, and we believed that the area north of Fairbanks was perfect for this endeavor. Initially, everything seemed normal as we settled into our new home. We bought 2 dozen chickens, several sheep, and a few horses. My responsibility was to feed the chickens, a task I despised. About a month after moving in, I noticed a small blood trail leading from the outside to the chicken coop. 3 chickens were missing, and there was blood all over their spot inside the coop, leading to the woodline. I informed my parents, and my father shared my suspicion that a fox or a coyote might be responsible. Little did we know that this was just the beginning. As days turned into weeks, the chicken situation worsened. Chickens continued to disappear, and within 3 weeks, our flock had dwindled from 2 dozen to just 8. Something unusual was happening. What perplexed us was the manner in which the chickens were killed. On some occasions, we found them dead in the coop with their heads twisted or missing, or completely torn into pieces. This behavior was strange for natural predators, as they typically killed for food, not just for the sake of it. Concerningly, my mother began to act strangely during this period. She slept less, mumbled to herself, and seemed to be losing her sanity. This was a stark departure from her usual quiet demeanor. One night, my mother took a violent turn and tried to attack my father with a butcher knife unprovoked. It took all of us, my 2 brothers, my sister, and my father, to restrain her. She had displayed incredible strength during this incident, making it necessary for my father to hold her down and take her to the hospital. My mother's condition worsened in the hospital, and she began to appear increasingly pale and sickly. We were left bewildered by her behavior and worried about her well-being. About a month later, my oldest brother, responsible for tending to the horses, experienced a terrifying encounter. He claimed to have seen a tall figure with yellow eyes and what appeared to be horns watching him from the woodline. This was a departure from his usual fearlessness in the face of wildlife encounters, and it left us unnerved. However, my younger brother and older sister dismissed his experience as a prank or a joke. As autumn approached and we prepared to return to school, my sister's life took a dark turn. She had few friends and was known for her social withdrawal. The passing of one of the few friends she had made at her new school plunged her into a deep depression. His passing had occurred under mysterious circumstances, as he had always been a cheerful and upbeat person. My sister's depression grew more severe, and she withdrew from social interactions entirely. She rarely left her room, ate only sporadically, and her transformation was unsettling. The atmosphere on our property also changed as autumn progressed. The once happy and carefree environment took on a dark and ominous feeling. We constantly felt as if we were being watched, on edge and unable to relax. Our senses were heightened, and we had a persistent feeling that something bad was about to happen. The fear was palpable, and our hair would stand on end at random moments. We were in a constant state of fight or flight. One night, my father woke me up in a panic, asking if I had seen my mother. I was confused because I assumed she was in bed. However, she was nowhere to be found, and we discovered her standing near the woodline outside the house, muttering about being called. We managed to bring her back inside, but her behavior remained erratic, and we grew increasingly concerned about her mental state. As we moved into October, the situation took a darker turn. The ominous atmosphere intensified, and my family's behavior became increasingly erratic. Livestock, including chickens, sheep, and horses, began to die mysteriously. These deaths were not the result of natural predators. The animals simply dropped dead. The unsettling events escalated, with entities visiting our house at night, banging on windows, clawing at the walls, and trying to gain entry. My mother's disturbing behavior continued, and she muttered about letting them in. In late October, my father and oldest brother discovered our beloved horse Maple, dead in her stall, her throat torn open and her innards exposed. The other horses were unharmed, but visibly terrified. This was devastating for my father and brother, as Maple was their favorite horse. The incident left us puzzled about what could have caused such a gruesome attack. We decided to seek help and brought in a priest to perform an exorcism on my mother. He believed she might be possessed, given her behavior. However, he claimed that the forces on the property were too strong and refused to perform the exorcism on the house. We were left with no other option but to leave the property, as the priest warned that these forces wouldn't let us leave alive. We eventually discovered that the property may have been cursed by an older native man who had a dispute with the previous owners. This man was rumored to be a witch who cursed the land after the deal fell through. Our family moved out, never to return to that cursed property again. The terrifying experiences we endured there still haunt us to this day, and we consider ourselves fortunate to have escaped with our lives. Now, over a decade later, I can share this chilling tale of the supernatural horrors that unfolded on that cursed property in the remote wilderness of Alaska. The day began like any other at Williams Field, the vast Alaskan landscape stretching out around me, unforgiving and relentless in its isolation. As an oil and gas worker in this harsh environment, I had grown accustomed to the solitude and the rugged beauty that came with it. My job kept me grounded, rooted in the practicalities of the daily grind, far removed from the intrigues and mysteries of the world beyond these fields. That morning, I was outside the surveyor's office, taking a break. The cold Alaskan air bit into my skin as I lit a cigarette, watching the plumes of smoke get swept away by the biting wind. There's a certain peace in the monotonous hum of machinery and the desolate beauty of the Alaskan wilderness, a peace that I had come to cherish in my years working here. But that peace was abruptly shattered when I saw him, an older gentleman, walking up the dirt road towards our site. He was an anomaly in this landscape, clad in a large fur coat that seemed more suited to a bygone era than a modern-day oil field. He moved with a purpose, a briefcase in his hand, which struck me as odd. Men in fur coats with briefcases weren't exactly a common sight around here. As he drew closer, a sense of unease began to take hold of me. It wasn't just his out-of-place attire or the briskness in his steps. It was his eyes. When he looked up at me, I felt a chill run down my spine, a feeling I hadn't known since my childhood days in the wilds of Wyoming, when every shadow in the woods could be a lurking predator. His eyes were wild, untamed, almost primal. They reminded me of the eyes of a predator, a bear or a wolf perhaps, sizing up its prey. It was a look that spoke of wildness, of a life lived outside the bounds of civilization. The man gave me a slight smirk, a knowing, almost mocking gesture, before quickly putting his head down and covering his face with his hat. Instinctively, I stepped back, my heart racing. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I called out, my voice edged with a mix of curiosity and apprehension. but he simply walked past me, ignoring my question, and entered the surveyor's office as if he owned the place. I stood there for a moment, trying to shake off the unease that had settled in my chest. The man's presence was an intrusion, a disruption of the predictable rhythm of my daily life. I couldn't shake the feeling that there was something off about him, something that went beyond his odd attire and unsettling gaze. I stubbed out my cigarette and made my way back to the office, my mind racing with questions. Who was this stranger? What business did he have in this remote corner of the world? His presence felt like a harbinger of change, an omen that the life I had known at Williams Field was about to be irrevocably altered. As I pushed open the door to the office, I braced myself for what might come next, the stranger's wild eyes still etched vividly in my mind, a haunting reminder that the wilderness wasn't just out there in the Alaskan expanse, but sometimes it walked right up to your doorstep. The door of the surveyor's office swung shut behind the stranger, and I was left standing there, a mix of curiosity and apprehension churning in my stomach. That man, with his wild eyes and anachronistic fur coat, was an enigma wrapped in a riddle. A puzzle that didn't fit into the rugged, unyielding landscape of Williams Field. I paced outside, the minutes stretching like hours. The cold Alaskan air did little to cool the heat of my racing thoughts. Who was this man? What was his business here? Questions buzzed in my mind like a hive of restless bees. Finally, the door opened, and the stranger emerged. This time, his eyes were different, normal, human, lacking the wild intensity that had so unnerved me earlier. He passed me without a word, his earlier smirk replaced by an unreadable expression. Watching him disappear down the dirt road, I felt a shiver that wasn't from the cold. There was something deeply unsettling about a man who could change so completely in the span of a few minutes. I turned and stepped into the office, eager for answers. My boss was there, his face ashen, a stark contrast to his usually unflappable demeanor. He looked like he'd seen a ghost, or worse. "What happened?" I asked, my voice barely above a whisper. He shook his head, as if to clear it, then looked at me. That was unexpected. He's interested in investing in the company, might even become a business partner. His words were mechanical, devoid of his usual confident tone. But it was more than just a potential business deal. I could see it in his eyes. Fear, confusion, a hint of disbelief. The man had proposed something that went beyond the ordinary, something that had shaken my boss to his core. "He made a proposal," my boss continued, his voice a strained whisper. "A choice, a small sum of money for a stake in the company, or..." He trailed off, his gaze distant. "Or what?" I pressed, sensing the gravity of what he was about to say. "A curse. On me, my family, the company." He laughed, a hollow, humorless sound. "Curses. Can you believe it?" But his eyes. I felt a cold knot form in my stomach. His eyes? They changed in the meeting, like a wild animal's, just like you said. My mind flashed back to the stranger's primal, unsettling gaze. A shudder ran through me. This was more than just a business deal gone awry. This was something out of a folktale. Something that didn't belong in the logical, predictable world of oil and gas. My boss didn't say much after that. He didn't need to. The fear in his eyes spoke volumes. We both knew that whatever this was, it was beyond our understanding, beyond our control. As I left the office, I couldn't shake the image of the stranger's eyes, nor the chilling proposition he had made. The wilderness of Alaska had always been a place of unfathomable mysteries, but this was something different, something darker. I couldn't help but feel that our quiet corner of the world had just become a stage for something much larger, much more sinister. And we were unwilling players in a game whose rules we didn't understand. The days following the stranger's visit to Williams Field were marked by a palpable tension, like the calm before a storm. The rugged, icy landscape of Alaska, once a symbol of unyielding strength and solitude, now seemed to whisper secrets with every gust of wind that swept across the oil fields. My boss, once a pillar of stoic pragmatism, had become a shadow of his former self. The decision to sell the company to the stranger, made in a haze of fear and disbelief, had sent ripples through our small community. I watched as the news was met with a mix of shock and resignation among my colleagues. The stranger, with his unsettling proposition and otherworldly presence, had changed everything. I spent my nights tossing and turning, the stranger's wild eyes haunting my dreams. They were eyes that spoke of ancient, unknowable things, of powers and forces that lay beyond the realm of our understanding. His presence had left a mark on me, an indelible imprint that challenged everything I believed about the world. In the days that followed, I found myself drawn to the mystery surrounding the stranger. Who was he? What was his true nature? I couldn't shake the feeling that he was more than just a man, perhaps a being from the old legends, a skinwalker or shapeshifter. Alaska was a land steeped in lore and superstition, and the stranger seemed to embody the very essence of these ancient tales. I would wander the fields, my eyes scanning the horizon, half expecting to see the stranger emerge from the wilderness, his figure materializing from the mist and shadows. But he never did. He had vanished as suddenly as he had appeared, leaving behind a trail of questions and a sense of unease that lingered in the air. My boss never spoke much about the deal or the stranger after that. He would only gaze into the distance, his eyes clouded with a mix of fear and regret. It was clear that whatever agreement he had made with the stranger, it had come at a great cost, a cost that went far beyond the financial implications. As time passed, the memory of the stranger began to fade, becoming nothing more than a whispered tale among the workers. But for me, it remained a vivid, unsettling memory, a reminder of the thin veil that separates the known from the unknown. Eventually, I moved on from Williams Field, seeking new opportunities in less haunted landscapes. But the echo of the stranger's presence stayed with me, a constant reminder of the mysteries that lurk in the wild corners of the world. I often find myself looking back on that encounter, wondering about the stranger's true intentions and the nature of the deal he struck with my boss. It's a puzzle that I know I'll never fully solve, a mystery as deep and impenetrable as the Alaskan wilderness itself. In the end, the stranger had not just brought a curse or a blessing to Williams Field. He had brought a reminder that some mysteries are too vast, too ancient, and too wild to ever be fully understood. I've always felt a deep connection to the Alaskan wilderness. It's where I feel most alive, where my senses heighten, and the world makes sense. As I packed my gear on that crisp October morning, the thrill of the hunt coursed through me. I was ready to embrace the wilderness once again. Leaving behind the small town where I lived, I drove along the rugged path leading to the bush. The old logging road, bumpy and unpaved, was like a gateway to another world. As my truck bounced along, I watched the sun peek over the horizon, casting a golden glow over the dense forest. The beauty of Alaska never failed to take my breath away. Arriving at my starting point, I checked my gear. I had everything I needed, my trusty rifle, a pair of binoculars, a map of the area, some snacks, and of course my old worn-out hunting jacket. It had been with me through countless hunts, a silent witness to my triumphs and failures in these woods. I set off on foot, the familiar crunch of leaves under my boots comforting. The air was fresh, and a slight chill nipped at my skin. As I walked, I let the sounds of the forest envelop me, the distant call of a bird, the rustle of small animals scurrying in the underbrush. This was my world, a place where I felt at home. My first stop was a tree stand I had set up years ago. It was like visiting an old friend. The wooden planks creaked under my weight as I climbed up. From my elevated vantage point, I scanned the area with my binoculars. This stand had always been a good spot for deer, but today, it seemed quiet, almost too quiet. Shrugging off a vague sense of unease, I moved on to the next location. Each tree stand offered a different view, a different opportunity. I knew these woods well, but every hunt was a new adventure, a chance to discover something I hadn't seen before. By midday, I'd visited several stands, but none felt quite right. I decided to push deeper into the forest, to a stand I hadn't used in a long time. It was located in a secluded valley, a bit of a hike, but I remembered it being a prime spot. As I trekked towards the valley, I noticed how the forest changed. The trees grew denser, the shadows longer. There was a stillness in the air that made me more alert. This part of the forest had a wilder feel, untouched and untamed. Reaching the old stand in the valley, I climbed up and settled in. The view here was spectacular. The creek nearby was a perfect draw for deer, and from my perch, I could see for miles. I felt a surge of excitement. This was it, the ideal spot. I sat there for a while, lost in thought, my rifle resting beside me. The peacefulness of the forest was a stark contrast to the adrenaline of the hunt, but that's what I loved about hunting, the balance between tranquility and excitement, the anticipation of the unknown. As the sun began its descent, casting long shadows through the trees, I felt a change in the air. A silence descended, a quiet so profound it was almost a presence in itself. I couldn't shake off the feeling that something was different. Something was off. Little did I know, as the shadows lengthened and the forest grew quiet, that my life was about to change forever. The valley was like a hidden gem tucked away in the vast Alaskan wilderness. As I settled into the tree stand, I couldn't help but feel a sense of pride for finding such a spot years ago. The creek nearby glistened under the afternoon sun, and the gentle rustle of leaves created a serene soundtrack. This was the perfect place for a hunter like me. I spent the first few hours just watching and waiting. From my perch, I had a clear view of the creek and the surrounding area. It was an ideal hunting ground, and I felt certain that deer would be drawn to the water. I scanned the area with my binoculars, looking for signs of movement. But as the afternoon wore on, the forest, usually teeming with life, grew strangely silent. At first I thought it might just be a lull, a momentary pause in the forest's rhythm. But the silence stretched on, pressing in around me. It was unusual. In all my years hunting, I had learned to read the signs of the wilderness, and this was different. The birds had stopped chirping, the small animals had ceased their rustling. It was as if the forest was holding its breath. As the sun began to dip lower in the sky, casting a golden hue over the trees, a sense of unease crept over me. I reminded myself that silence in the Alaskan bush often meant predators were nearby. Bears and wolves were common in these parts, and I was well aware of the dangers they posed. I checked my rifle, ensuring it was loaded and within easy reach, just in case. The transition from day to night in the bush is something I've always found fascinating. The way the light changes, the way the sounds shift. But that evening, the fascination was tinged with apprehension. The forest felt different, almost as if it were aware of something I wasn't. Nightfall brought a new set of sounds, or rather, the absence of them. The quiet was pervasive, enveloping. I strained my ears for any sign of life, but there was nothing. Not a rustle, not a twig snap, nothing. The usual nocturnal chorus was conspicuously absent. Then, the first sound in hours, a distant crashing, like something large moving through the underbrush. My first thought was a bear, maybe a moose. I gripped my rifle, peering into the dimming light, trying to catch a glimpse of whatever was out there. But the crashing was erratic, not the steady, purposeful stride of a bear or moose. As darkness enveloped the valley, the crashing sounds seemed to circle around, moving closer, then away, then closer again. It was disconcerting. I've faced down bears and other predators before, but this felt different. The pattern was unlike any animal I knew. My heart raced, adrenaline coursing through me. Every hunter's instinct I had screamed that something was off. I settled into a restless vigil, my eyes scanning the darkness, my ears straining for any sound. The night air was cool, and I could see my breath misting in front of me. I felt a primal fear, a sense of being hunted, and I didn't like it. I was the hunter, not the prey. But that night, in the depths of the Alaskan bush, I wasn't so sure anymore. The darkness in the Alaskan bush is like a blanket. thick and all-encompassing. That night, as I sat in my tree stand, the blackness seemed to press in on me from all sides. The sounds I had heard earlier, the crashing through the underbrush, had stopped. Now there was only silence, a heavy, oppressive silence. I kept my rifle close, my senses on high alert. In all my time hunting, I had never felt so uneasy, so on edge. I knew the dangers of the wilderness, but this was different. This was fear, raw and unfiltered. Hours passed, or at least it felt like hours. Time has a way of stretching out when you're scared. My eyes were glued to the night vision scope, scanning the area around the creek. That's when I saw her, a lone doe, cautiously stepping out to drink. I watched her, admiring her grace, aware of how vulnerable she was out in the open. But then, something else caught my eye. A shape, a form, something moving in the shadows. My heart pounded in my chest as I focused on it. It was big, bigger than any bear I'd ever seen, and it moved with a terrifying grace. Before I could even process what I was seeing, it pounced on the doe with a speed and ferocity that took my breath away. I stared, frozen in shock, as the creature tore into the doe. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't a wolf. I didn't know what it was. It was like something out of a nightmare, black and monstrous, with an elongated face and what looked like spines or quills running down its back. The way it moved, the way it ripped apart the doe, it was nothing like any animal I'd ever encountered. Panic set in, a cold, hard knot in the pit of my stomach. I was alone, miles from anywhere, with a creature from a horror movie. My mind raced, trying to figure out what to do. I couldn't stay here, not with that thing out there. But how could I leave? How could I make it back to my truck without it seeing me? Then, as if sensing my fear, the creature stopped eating. It lifted its head, turning towards me. Our eyes met, even from that distance, and a chill ran down my spine. It started moving towards me, slow and deliberate. I could hear its footsteps, heavy and certain. I ducked down in the tree stand, gripping my rifle. My heart was pounding so loud I was sure it could hear it. It got closer and closer until it was right below me. I could hear it sniffing, smell the blood and gore from its recent kill. Then, in a moment of sheer terror, it reached up. A hand, not a paw, a hand with long, sharp claws, tore through the floor of the tree stand, grazing my leg. I screamed in pain and fear, firing my gun at it. The creature howled, a sound that was part roar, part scream, and retreated into the darkness. I sat there, shaking and bleeding, listening to the sounds of the creature moving away. I knew I had to get out of there, but I was paralyzed with fear. What if it was still out there waiting for me? What if it came back? The night stretched on, an endless cycle of fear and pain. I was trapped, injured, and alone, with a creature from my worst nightmares lurking in the darkness. The longest night of my life slowly gave way to the first light of dawn. Throughout those endless dark hours, I sat in the tree stand, my injured leg throbbing with pain, my mind racing with fear. Every rustle in the underbrush, every whisper of wind through the trees, had me clutching my rifle tighter, expecting the worst. I thought about the creature, that terrifying, unexplainable being. The way it looked at me, the way it moved. It was like something out of a horror story. I had always been the hunter, always in control, but that night, I had become the hunted. As the first rays of sun filtered through the trees, I realized I had to make a move. I couldn't stay in the tree stand forever. I had to get back to my truck, get back to safety. But the fear of encountering that creature again was almost paralyzing. What if it was still out there? What if it was waiting for me to come down? I gathered my courage, knowing I had no other choice. I slowly and painfully made my way down from the tree stand, my legs screaming in protest. Every step was agony, but fear propelled me forward. I had to get out of that valley, had to put as much distance between me and that thing as possible. The forest, which had always been a place of solace and peace for me, now felt ominous and threatening. Every shadow seemed to hide dangers. Every sound made me jump. I kept expecting to see the creature emerge from behind a tree or rise up from the underbrush. But the forest was quiet, eerily quiet. I limped as fast as I could, trying to be as quiet as possible. My leg was a mess, blood seeping through the torn fabric of my pants, pain shooting up with every step. I knew I needed medical attention, but first, I had to survive. The journey back to the truck felt like an eternity. Every step was a struggle against pain and fear, but the thought of that creature, of its inhuman eyes and terrifying strength, kept me moving. I had to escape, had to survive. Finally, after what seemed like hours, I saw my truck through the trees. I had never been so relieved in my life. I practically fell against it, tears of pain and relief streaming down my face. I was safe, at least for the moment. As I drove away from the valley, I couldn't help but look back, half expecting to see the creature following me. But the forest was silent, giving up no secrets. I knew I would never return to that place, never again feel safe in the wilderness I had once loved so much. That day changed me. It took away my sense of invincibility, my confidence in the wilderness. I had come face to face with something unexplainable, something terrifying, and it had left its mark on me. I would carry the memory of that night, of the Alaskan Devil, with me for the rest of my life. I'm a seasonal caretaker at a national park in Alaska, a job that's as remote as it gets. I won't disclose the specific park's name, as my employers have warned me to keep quiet about the peculiar occurrences I've witnessed during my 3 years on the job. Nonetheless, I feel compelled to share some of the unsettling experiences I've had in this desolate wilderness. You might wonder what a seasonal caretaker does, and I wouldn't blame you. It's not the most thrilling occupation, I'll admit. My tenure begins when the park shuts down for the winter, and my primary responsibilities involve maintaining the various cabins and public buildings, while ensuring the roofs stay clear of snow to prevent damage. In essence, it's a solitary job, and if you're a social butterfly, it's definitely not for you. It takes a certain breed to willingly isolate themselves for 3 month stretches, fully aware that there's no escape until the snow melts and the plows clear the access roads to my cabin. I do have a snowmobile for the occasional 3 hour trek to the nearest ranger station, but it's hardly a jaunt to the corner store. For me, it's a perfect fit. I've always leaned towards solitude, and my loyal companion Duke, a Jack Russell Terrier, keeps me company. The work isn't overly demanding. I typically spend just a few days each week attending to my duties, leaving the rest of my time free. A few years ago, I took up nature photography as a hobby to pass the hours, and some of my photos have even been published by a reputable organization. During the warmer months, this park teems with visitors, making it a hotspot for outdoor enthusiasts in this part of Alaska. However, in the winter, it becomes an icy wasteland, inhabited only by a few isolated ranger stations. Weeks can pass without me encountering a single soul, and the only regular interaction I have is with my fellow ranger, whom I'll call James. We chat a few times a week over the radio, and apart from that, it's just Duke and me. It's challenging to describe some of the eerie things I've witnessed in the cold, desolate winter days, but I'll start with the shades, as I call them in my private musings. I have no clue what they really are, but they only appear during heavy snowstorms. The more intense the storm, the closer they venture to my cabin. It's like watching figures move behind frosted glass, their forms indistinct and shadowy. Initially, I dismiss them as figments of my imagination, my mind finding patterns in the swirling chaos of snowfall. But then, I began to hear them too. Soft murmurs, barely audible above the howling wind. Unintelligible whispers that set my nerves on edge. One thing's for sure, they've only ever shown up during brutal storms, and they terrify me. If I know a storm is approaching, I make sure all my doors and windows are locked well before nightfall. Once, during a particularly vicious blizzard, they surrounded my cabin. I could see their shadowy forms and hear their incomprehensible mutterings, like a macabre procession. That night was sheer terror. At one point, the doorknob on my front door slowly turned, accompanied by soft scratching against the wooden surface. But the most chilling part, I swear on my life, was the faint whisper calling my name from the other side of the door, an hour-long torment that still haunts my dreams. It sounded like a voice stripped of its soul, neither alive nor dead, an inexplicable horror I can't adequately put into words. Imagine someone's soul being torn from their body. It was like that. I may sound dramatic, but that's how it felt, and I shudder at the mere thought of what might have happened if I hadn't remembered to engage the deadbolt that night. I'm in no hurry to find out. Just recalling it sends shivers down my spine. I confided in James the next day, after the storm had subsided enough for me to get a radio signal out. I half expected him to laugh off my fear, attributing it to the darkness and isolation. However, he didn't. With a calm and stern demeanor, he warned me not to discuss them, and simply advised locking up tightly during heavy snowstorms. My attempts to extract more information from him proved futile, as he adamantly refused to elaborate, except for one unsettling remark. Winter didn't lull everything into slumber up here. That cryptic statement sent shivers down my spine, and I'm determined to press James for more information one day. Next on my list is the Carr graveyard. It sounds unbelievable, but if you venture far enough off the beaten path in this wilderness, you're likely to stumble upon one. Cars or trucks, inexplicably abandoned in the heart of the Alaskan backcountry. It defies all logic. The first one I encountered was a 2003 BMW coupe, as pristine as if it had just rolled off the showroom floor. Yet half of it was embedded in an ancient spruce tree, seemingly fused with it. It was as though the tree had grown around the car, or the car had been inserted into the tree. Impossible, I know, but I swear it was there. And I've seen more of them during my tenure, sometimes wedged in trees like the BMW, and other times inexplicably situated in open spaces. Each one looked freshly driven, defying reason as to how they got there, even without the peculiar tree situation. What's even more unnerving about these abandoned vehicles is the clothing. I stopped investigating long ago and now steer clear of them, but the first time I encountered one, curiosity compelled me to inspect it. The doors were locked, but when I peered through the windows, I saw something eerie. In the front seats, clothes were laid out meticulously, pants, shirts, socks, shoes, everything you'd wear, strapped in with seatbelts, as if the occupants had vanished mid-drive, leaving their clothes behind exactly as they'd worn them. It was eerie, to say the least, and it sent chills down my spine. Another unsettling aspect is that I've never seen the same vehicle twice. I returned the day after spotting that first BMW, camera in hand, intending to snap a picture, but it had vanished. I was certain I was in the right spot, as my footprints in the snow from the previous day confirmed. When I tried to report these strange sightings to the Rangers, James informed me that they no longer bothered investigating them. By the time anyone arrived, the vehicles had disappeared. Apparently, reports of such occurrences have cropped up periodically for the past few decades, shrouded in mystery and lacking any logical explanation. James did mention that one ranger had discovered a school bus from Texas once. Inside, every seat was piled high with empty clothes, except for the driver's seat. The ranger described the driver as being there but not quite, like a blurry hologram frozen in time. The elderly driver appeared in a perpetual state of terrified shock, with wide eyes and an open mouth. The ranger attempted to enter the bus through the rear emergency door, but as he opened it, a deafening buzzing filled his ears, and an electric shock-like vibration coursed through his body. The closer he got, the more intense the sensation became. He likened it to pushing two strong magnets together. Resistance increased with proximity. It was as if the universe itself was barring his entry, as if he didn't belong. He stumbled away, falling ill for days afterward. When he returned with other rangers, the bus had vanished. As for the buzzing and vibration, I can't personally vouch for them. I simply steer clear of those vehicles. They're simply not right. The last eerie tale I'll share involves a rope bridge about a mile from my cabin, The bridge spans a deep ravine, with a rocky outcrop beside it, often used as an observation point. Typically, hikers stop here to take selfies during the warmer months. But in winter, the park is closed, and access is blocked by chains on the roads to prevent visitors from straying. I hike to this bridge roughly once a week, scouting for new photo opportunities to pass the time. The trek is picturesque, and the landscape radiates with pristine beauty, untouched by human presence. I've captured some breathtaking shots of the bridge, but I never dare to step onto it in the freezing cold. The boards are perpetually icy and treacherous. A misstep could send me sliding, plummeting 200 feet to the rocky abyss below before I even realize what's happening. However, here's the eerie part. Whenever I reach that bridge, I find multiple sets of footprints leading up to the rocky outcrop, but none leading away from it. These prints originate from various directions, some from the path, others emerging from the trees, yet they all seem to halt at the precipice of the ravine. They vary in size and stride, some so small, others belonging to titanic figures. The first time I noticed them, I worried that trespassers had met a tragic end, inching too close to the edge and toppling over. But after spending a full day meticulously descending to the ravine floor, I found no trace of anyone other than myself. I might not be a tracking expert, but I can tell when footprints lead up to a location and don't return. On one occasion, I dared to venture onto the rocky outcrop in an attempt to unravel the mystery. I thought perhaps there was a concealed path I hadn't noticed. But the moment my foot touched the stone, agony seized my head, a throbbing pain akin to the worst hangover. As I staggered back, the pain vanished as suddenly as it had appeared, leaving me with an insistent nosebleed that persisted throughout the day. I never attempted that again. Even Duke refuses to go near it. He starts whining the moment we approach that part of the trail. Mind you, this is a dog who's been known to confront packs of wolves that dared approach our territory. Despite his small stature, he lacks the self-preservation instinct, except when it comes to that overlook. Even Duke has his limits, it seems. I have more stories to share, but I'm growing weary, and it's time for me to get some rest. Tomorrow, I'll need to head out to the cabins by the frozen lake and ensure their roofs are clear. I promise to write more later, and next time, I'll tell you about the dead bears. It's a strange one, that's for sure. Thanks for all the great feedback on my previous post. Honestly, I wasn't sure how interested anyone would be in some of the things going on out here, and I was more than a little surprised when I got back to my cabin yesterday and saw all the responses. Before I get rolling with some more experiences I've had out here, I just wanted to address a few questions or comments that folks have made on my last update. Someone suggested that I should try to capture the shades with my camera. That's a good suggestion, and I've already tried that on a couple of occasions. The issue I've run into is that, because of the darkness and the snow, I only really have two options. Either use a flash or some other light source, or else use a long shutter speed on my cameras. Even though I was pretty sure neither one would work, I have actually tried both methods. Unfortunately, as anyone who has driven in a snowstorm can attest, snow is great at reflecting light, which is why you can't use your high beams when driving in it. The light just reflects off the snow and back into your eyes, effectively blinding you. My results using this method were about what you'd expect. Nothing but a complete whiteout of the captured images. Using a slow shutter speed didn't yield any better results. All I got were images of completely incomprehensible motion blurs. I suppose there are probably better camera rigs out there that may be able to overcome these challenges, but I don't know of them. Even if they do exist, they're probably well outside of my budget. The National Park Service doesn't exactly pay seasonal caretakers in gold bullion. There was also a concern that, even though I'm trying to remain anonymous, I've given away enough details about myself that my employers could easily identify me. Don't worry about that. Firstly, there are more than 20 national parks in Alaska, covering over 50 million acres of land. Believe it or not, it actually contains the majority of the national park land in the entire United States, something like 65% of it. As you can imagine, there are a lot of folks spread across the state doing similar jobs to mine. it's hard to envision exactly how expansive Alaska is, and how much of it is covered with stark wilderness unless you've been here and seen it for yourself. I know that I didn't have the faintest clue before I got here from the lower 48. I guess the bottom line is that it's pretty unlikely that anyone from the NPS will be able to identify me from what I've told you about myself. If they do, I guess we'll cross that bridge then. Finally, someone asked about the license plates on some of the vehicles that mysteriously appear out here in the wilderness, and whether they were all from one area or from all over. I've previously mentioned that I tend to avoid them if I come across them anymore, but I can tell you that the first car I ran across, the BMW, had a European-style license plate on the front. I assumed at the time that it was just one of those trendy plates that folks in the US sometimes put on the front of their Europeans' cars for decoration, but it's possible that it was legitimately from somewhere in Europe. I'm not sure. I recall that it was white and blue, but beyond that, I don't remember much about it. Of course, the bus that the ranger found had Texas plates on it, but I don't know about any others. Sorry. Okay, so now that I've cleared those points up, let's dive into some of the other things going on out here. Since I mentioned it in my previous post, I'll start off with the bears. So, you probably already know this, but Alaska has some of the largest and most dangerous bears in the entire world. Fortunately, the Kodiak and the polar bear aren't generally found inland up here, but we still have more than our fair share of grizzlies and large black bears, both of which are apex predators, and will make quick work of the unwary or unprepared. Now, since my contract covers the colder winter months, most of these bears are hibernating during my time here. That being said, not all bears hibernate, especially if they're in an area of plentiful food supply. Also, even when they are hibernating, they'll still become active from time to time, so you definitely can't let your guard down if you want to stay on this side of the grave. It's a pretty safe bet that anyone who works up here, especially alone, tends to carry a rifle as well as a large caliber handgun whenever they're outside of their cabin. I'm no exception to that. I carry a .45-70 lever action over my shoulder and a 500 Magnum revolver in a chest holster. At first glance, it may seem like overkill. That is a tremendous amount of firepower, after all. However, the first time you catch a glimpse of a mama grizzly with her cubs, and realize that you're looking at an 800-pound predator that can run you down in a heartbeat, you'll start wondering why I don't carry even more. The reason I mention all this isn't to give you the impression that there's some sort of mythical monsters hiding behind every tree just waiting to pounce, only that they represent the top of the food chain up here, period. Nothing, and I mean nothing, short of a pack of starving wolves, will even threaten one. And even that's only been documented on a handful of occasions. They're massive, powerful, and aggressive. And if you live out in their territory and don't keep your head on a swivel, you're an idiot, and probably soon to be converted into bear crap. So, all that being the case, I'm sure you'll understand what it means when I tell you that something is killing big grizzlies out here. I'm not talking about poachers or indigenous hunters or anything like that. I'm talking about something, as in, not humans, and definitely not hungry wolves. But let me back up a step. My first season up here as a winter caretaker was a hell of a learning experience. Just trying to figure out the necessary maintenance routines and learning to navigate around my area of responsibility was a little overwhelming. One day, I was returning from making my rounds out to one of the ranger stations that was shut down for the winter and ended up taking a wrong turn on the trail. By the time I realized my mistake, I was already a fair distance along the new path and wandering into unfamiliar territory. Just as I was getting ready to turn around and retrace my steps, I topped a rise and was suddenly faced with the unmistakable form of a grizzly, not 30 feet along the path ahead and facing away from me. I've got to tell you, I almost pissed myself as I fumbled to unsling the rifle from my shoulder. It's a damned good thing I didn't actually need it at that moment, because I discovered to my dismay that I had stupidly slung my shoulder pack over top of the rifle sling, effectively trapping it against my body. Stupidity and complacency are what get you killed out here, folks, and I could have been a perfect example of both at that moment. As it turns out, the bear wasn't moving. It was just standing there perfectly still, its hindquarters facing me, and I knew instinctively that something was wrong with it. Giving up on my rifle, I grabbed my handgun from its holster and cautiously approached the grizzly, my eyes intent on the bear and prepared for the slightest hint of movement. The closer I got to it, though, the more certain I became that it wasn't going to suddenly lunge at me and give me a lesson on exactly where on the food chain I placed. Here's where it gets surreal. Before I got close to it, I had already recognized that it was dead. What I couldn't explain was why it was still standing. It had clearly been there a while, as there were no paw prints leading up to it in the snow, and as I rounded to the front of it, I could see the flesh around its muzzle was already starting to decompose and pull back from its skull. When I got a good look at it, I could also see that it was missing tufts of fur here and there. Despite all that, it was still standing, like it had died and just forgotten to fall down. I looked it over pretty closely, which was still an unnerving exercise, dead or not, but I couldn't find any sort of wounds that might indicate why it had died. It was then that I realized a couple of things. Firstly, that there were grizzlies in the area that were active, and secondly, nothing had scavenged the carcass. To say this is unusual is an understatement. Most of the top carnivores in this area, including wolves, wolverines, and foxes, supplement their diets by scavenging on carrion. The fact that this bear had died and remained completely intact wasn't just perplexing, it was unnatural. I reported the find to the ranger station and heard back later from James that there had been nearly a dozen other similar discoveries within that general area in the last 2 months. The NPS had even brought in some fancy zoological pathologists from Anchorage to figure out what had killed the bears. They spent 2 weeks in the field with the rangers examining the carcasses, and then one morning, they were just gone. They had apparently been abruptly recalled without so much as a buy or leave. Immediately after that, the carcasses were destroyed, and the investigation shut down. A week later, a rushed and astonishingly brief report came back indicating death by natural predation. No further investigation indicated. Natural predation. I'm not sure how a predator could have killed the bear I found without leaving a single mark on it, or trace of blood, let alone somehow keep it standing upright after death, and then deciding it wasn't even going to feed on the kill. I call bullcrap, and so did the rangers. James told me his boss had tried to contact the pathologist for more information, but was told that they had all been reassigned and were no longer working with the Park Service. Not one to easily give up, James's boss tried calling a private cell number he had gotten from one of the pathologists during their visit. It went to a disconnected message, indicating the phone was no longer in service. This was strange, because he had just spoken to the investigator using that very number only a couple weeks prior, so he knew it was a good number. But late that night, he received a call from an unknown caller. When he answered it, he recognized the hushed voice of the pathologist he had befriended, sounding like they were whispering into their phone. "Leave it alone. Forget about it," was all they said before the line went dead. He tried calling the number back several times, but it just went to dead air each time. That was the last time he heard anything about it. He tried following up within the NPS, but somehow nobody was able to find records that such an investigation had ever existed, or even that any reports of the dead bears had been filed in the first place. James told me that for a while, it was all his boss wanted to talk about. It had become like a splinter in his hand that he couldn't ignore. He called anyone he could think of in the chain of command at the NPS and any other agencies he thought might be able to provide some clue about what was going on, but couldn't make an inch of headway. Then, one day, he just stopped talking about it, like a switch had been thrown. One evening, James and his boss were having beers at a local bar after their shift and talking about how strange the whole thing was. And then the next morning, his boss walked in, looking a little shaky and out of sorts, went into his office and closed the door, and didn't say two words to James that day. He never mentioned the incident again. A few times James had brought it up in conversation with him later on, and his boss just brushed the whole thing off and changed subjects, looking very uncomfortable about the whole thing. I don't know what happened, but if I had to guess, I'm thinking that his boss was probably digging into something that wasn't meant to be dug into, and someone had convinced him it was better if he just forgot about it. Look, I'm not some conspiracy theorist nutjob, okay? I just know that the whole thing stinks to high hell, and I'll just leave it at that. The other thing I'll tell you about today is what we call the Witch's Lodge. I'm not sure what it was originally. It's really not much more than a single-room log cabin built out in the deep bush. I've seen it a couple of times and been inside once. It's a bit of a hike from my post and not somewhere easily traveled, even by snowmobile, so I don't get out that way very often. Old abandoned cabins aren't really that unusual up here. You'll trip across them from time to time, although most aren't much more than a few walls and a collapsed roof after the years, and harsh Alaskan winters get through with them. The Witch's Lodge is a little different, though. As far as I'm aware, nobody's lived there for a long time, but whoever built it must have known what they were doing, because it looks every bit as solid and maintained as my own cabin. I'm not even sure how it got its name, honestly. I just know that's how it was introduced to me the first time. So that's how I'm introducing it to you. A couple of years ago, my ranger buddy, James, radioed me up asking if I wouldn't mind joining him in a search for a couple of missing hikers, a father and his 12-year-old son. I'm just a caretaker. I don't normally participate in ranger or search and rescue related activities, but apparently there wasn't anyone else available to accompany him on that day, and he had gotten a lead that the hikers may have been heading out into my section of the park. In search and rescue efforts, especially during the dark Alaska winters, finding someone quickly is critical if you want to find them alive, so he wanted to follow up on it sooner than later. Of course, I couldn't exactly refuse to help him, especially not when one of them was just a kid. So a couple of hours later, I found myself trailing behind him through the knee-deep snow. We moved along a semi-familiar path for a while before he turned left at a fork, and we started making our way along another that I wasn't familiar with. He seemed like he knew where he was headed, like he had a particular destination in mind, though, and we really didn't talk much during the hike. We stopped a couple of times to rest and sip some hot coffee from our thermoses, but even then, we were both quiet. I think there was some sort of dark cloud hanging over his mood. I could see it in his narrowed eyes and drawn brow. It was infectious, and soon started manifesting itself in the back of my own mind. An hour later, we came upon the place. I was surprised to see this perfectly preserved little cedar log cabin, just sitting out here among the trees and looking for all the world like someone would come walking out of the front door at any moment. Something about the place seemed off, though. Somehow, I knew that nobody lived there, that nobody had lived there in a long time. I can't explain it, but at that moment, I had this strange feeling that we weren't welcome here, like something was telling me to turn around and head back while I still could. Before I had the chance to open my mouth about it, James turned to me and pointed towards the closed front door, where I could clearly see the boot prints at its threshold. "Come on," he said over the wind that had just blown up, and I could see the grim set to his expression before he turned away from me and started making his way towards the door. I noticed that he had drawn his handgun, so I did the same, though I had no idea why. We reached the entryway to the cabin, and he put his hand on the latch. Before he lifted it, he paused and looked back at me with that same dark expression. "We're going to have to look inside," he said. "If there's nothing to be found in there, fine. We'll just turn around and head back to your cabin for a couple of glasses of whiskey by the fire. Maybe the other groups will find them then." His eyes fixed hard on mine, like he wanted to make sure I was paying damned good attention to him. "But if we find anyone other than this idiot hiker and his kid inside, we're not going to look at them, and we're not going to say a single word to them, understand? Even if they talk to us first." I nodded at him, more confused than anything else, but that wasn't good enough. "I need you to say it, Jim, to make sure you understand what I'm telling you," he said, and the set of his eyes was so serious and determined that I repeated his instructions back to him without a second thought. When I did, he gave a brief nod and lifted the latch, pushing the door inward. We stepped through the doorway into the darkened room beyond. As soon as we did, I was overwhelmed by the stench of decay, mixed with a strong sense of herbs and something else, something sickly riding just under the surface of all that. My eyes had just started to adjust to the dim light of the interior, and I was able to make out the sparse furnishings of the room. An old rickety table with a solitary low-backed chair in front of a cold stone fireplace. Along the far wall, I thought I could just make out a cot, but I couldn't be sure. "Damn it, it's happened again," James said, almost under his breath, and the tone of warning in his voice drew my attention immediately. I turned to find him kneeling next to the desiccated husk of a man's body, dressed in gray snow pants and a red down jacket, slumped back against the wall. It looked like it had been there for years, and I stumbled backward in shock without realizing it. "What the crap?" I exclaimed, not really knowing what else to say. James picked up something that was resting on the floor near the man's skeletal hand, looked around briefly at the room, and then nodded to the door. "Time to go. I'll let the search and rescue team know that we found the hikers," he said. I was more than a little confused. The body we were looking at was almost mummified. It had clearly been there a long time, and I told him as much, not to mention the fact that there was only one of them. If it was possible that this was the father, that still meant that the son was somewhere out here. "It's too late, Jim," was all he said, pressing something into my hands as he passed me and stepped out the door. I looked down and realized I was holding a small notebook, like the kind a person might keep in their pocket, just in case they needed to write something down. Numbly, I flipped it open. It was mostly empty, except for the first two pages, which were scrawled in sloppy cursive in pencil. "I don't have it anymore, so this is going to be as well as I remember it, but it should be close enough that you get the gist of it. We found her cabin. God, I wish we hadn't. Nathan's gone. She took him. I've been wandering around in here for days, but I can't find my way out. I haven't seen Nathan or her since that first day. My boy is gone. How can I not find my way out? What's happening?" I can hear her whispers taunting me, but it's always just a little farther forward, around the next corner. "I don't understand any of this. I'm so sorry." As it turns out, we did end up heading back to my cabin. James radioed the search and rescue team that he'd found the hikers in the lodge, and the person on the other end paused a long moment before replying with a simple acknowledgement. No questions, nothing else, just acknowledged James. We didn't say much to each other that night. We just sat in front of my fire and drank the rest of my Jameson until we both passed out. When I returned to consciousness the next morning, James had already gotten up and left. We haven't spoken about it since that day. The notebook was gone when I awoke, so I assume he took that with him. Clearly, he knows something about what happened, about that cabin, but I've never asked him about it. I'm not too sure I really want to know. It's hard enough to sleep at night out here sometimes. Speaking of which, I suppose it's time for me to sign off and get some shut-eye. It's already almost 2 in the morning, and I've got a long day's work ahead of me tomorrow. It snowed pretty good today, and I was already behind in clearing the roof of the storage sheds over near the old fire watchtower. I'd rather not have to deal with the damage if the roof collapses, so I'd better get over there as soon as it lets up some outside. I'll write some more soon. Good night, all. I'm back again, but I think this may be my last post. The situation has taken a terrifying turn, and after this update, I'm going to lay low and try to disappear. Let me bring you up to speed on what's happened, as I recount these events from my perspective. The day started like any other, in the heart of an Alaskan winter. I was getting suited up, preparing to head down to the storage sheds near the old fire watchtower. In this remote, closed national park, visitors were a rarity. My only regular companions were my ranger buddy James, and the supplier who brought me fresh provisions every few weeks. When I heard a knock on the door to my cabin, my heart skipped a beat. James never showed up at my door without first calling on the radio. His unexpected arrival was a cause for concern. I opened the door, and he entered, his expression deeply troubled. "Hell, James. You gave me quite a start," I chuckled nervously, trying to dispel the unease that hung in the air. I knew something was amiss, and I had a gut feeling it might involve me. James, his face etched with a mixture of worry and anger, turned away from the fireplace. He had something on his mind, something that had shaken him to the core. "I got a call last night, Jim," he said, his voice flat, "and so did a few other rangers." "Oh yeah?" I replied nonchalantly, though my heart was pounding. James removed his wool cap, running a hand through his neat hair. "Yeah, it was about you," he said, pointing at me with his cap. "You've attracted attention with those stories you've been posting online." "My stories? What stories?" I asked, feigning innocence. I hadn't shared the details of these posts with James. Though we discussed the idea before, I hadn't admitted to writing them. As far as he knew, I was just talking. Despite the cabin's low temperature, sweat began to bead on my palms. I had been certain that no one could trace these posts back to me, believing that I'd concealed the details well enough. But I had underestimated the determination of those who sought to uncover the author. In hindsight, my error was clear. If someone aimed to identify the source of these posts, they would start by investigating rangers who knew the terrain intimately, like James and me. I had hoped that my friendship with James would protect me, that he would turn a blind eye. But in a situation like this, our loyalties were tested. The Witch's Lodge, a pseudonym I'd used, wasn't its real name, yet James could likely identify it from my descriptions. The same applied to the other stories. I had underestimated the resourcefulness of those who knew the terrain as well as we did. I panicked internally, realizing that my secret was exposed. Crap, I messed up this time. James tilted his head, and his stern expression signaled he was in no mood for games. "You know which stories, Jim," he said firmly. "The ones I warned you about, the ones I knew would get you into trouble." I tried to downplay it, to minimize the consequences. "They were just stories on the internet, James. A bit of fun to stave off the loneliness out here. You understand, right?" "Yeah, well, those fun stories have stirred up trouble for both of us," James said, placing his hat on a chair and turning back to the fireplace. "They know who wrote them. They know who you are." Stunned, I stood there, mouth agape, comprehension dawning. "You told them?" I asked incredulously. I had been naive, failing to consider that James had a duty to uphold, that he was bound by his commitments. I hoped there was remorse in his eyes, that our friendship held some value. "What did you expect?" James retorted, without turning to face me. His frustration, perhaps tinged with regret, was palpable. "That they'd look the other way again? This isn't your first time pulling something like this, Jim." Silence lingered, but beneath it lay an unspoken truth. My actions had consequences, ones I couldn't escape. James's duty had clashed with our friendship. In a moment of desperation, as I grappled with the inevitability of my predicament, I acted. My magnum was drawn from its holster, and the deafening crack of the gunshot filled the cabin's confined space. Smoke hung in the air, and the flash momentarily blinded me. James staggered to the side, his own firearm tumbling to the floor. He clutched at the crimson hole in his chest, gasping for air with a wet, rattling breath. "I'm sorry, James," I muttered, grabbing my belongings and slinging my rifle over my shoulder. "I messed it all up. I'm sorry." James's vacant gaze fixated on nothing as his life slipped away. The pool of red spread beneath him, marking the end of a friendship shattered by my impulsive act. That was this morning. I hastily left the cabin, strapping my pack onto the snowmobile. Within moments, I was speeding along the northern trail, leaving my cabin behind and heading toward the decommissioned ranger station. I had taken a life, a friend's life. In the heat of the moment, it felt like self-preservation, but the guilt weighed heavily on me. I knew there would be no reprieve this time. Now I sit in the dim back room of the ranger station, my snowmobile concealed in the shadows, hidden beneath a tarp and a layer of freshly fallen snow. I hope the snowfall obscures my tracks, granting me a precious reprieve. My hands shake as I write this, my fingers typing frantically on the notebook computer. Surprisingly, the agency hasn't yet locked down the firewalls, allowing me to relay this message through the ranger station's communication network. Time is running out. I don't know what awaits me, but there's no turning back. My true identity is Jim Clark, and my affiliation with the government goes deeper than I've admitted. But revealing more would risk the suppression of this message by the Raptor AI protocols. My role here was more than just a caretaker. It involved keeping watch on intruders, on creatures, on the byproducts of their clandestine experiments. What they do beneath the mountain is beyond my comprehension. You should avoid national parks, perhaps even state parks. The horrors I've witnessed, the secrets they guard. I can't erase what I've done, but I can warn you to stay away. It's for your own safety. As I reflect on the terrifying truths I've shared, a sense of impending doom fills the air. It's as if the shadows themselves are closing in on me. There's a noise, a real one this time, and my paranoia escalates. Time is short. I must upload this post, hoping it reaches the world before they intervene. My fate is sealed, but I hope my words will serve as a warning to those who stumble upon this tale of fear and secrets.